Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online, After Midnight.
For a long time, he tried to isolate the event. That's how his mind wanted to handle it. Pull the moment apart, examine it from every angle, and decide whether it belonged in the category of exhaustion, trauma, or imagination. If he could assign it to one of those, then it would stop demanding his attention. But the problem was never the moment itself. It was everything connected to it. He had been home from active duty for only a few months. 5 years in the infantry had ended abruptly, not with closure, but with distance. Distance from danger. Distance from routine. Distance from the constant vigilance that had shaped every waking hour overseas. Coming home felt unreal. So he did what a lot of people do when the pressure finally lifts. He filled the silence with noise. Drinking, staying awake, letting nights blur into mornings, letting weekends stretch until they lost shape entirely. It wasn't reckless in his mind. It was release. By the time Friday rolled into Saturday, sleep had become optional. 48 hours passed in a haze of exhaustion and stimulation. Eventually, his friends left, and he and his fiancé collapsed into bed in their small one-bedroom apartment, and the lights were off. The room was completely dark. He had just closed his eyes when she sat bolt upright. He opened his eyes and turned toward her, already trying to orient himself, already reaching for that part of his brain trained to assess threats. That was when he saw it. Something sat on her side of the bed. It was dark green, not shadow, not black, but a color that stood out against the darkness in a way he couldn't explain. Lanky, thin, too thin. Its limbs were elongated, its body narrow and awkwardly proportioned, like something assembled incorrectly. One arm was extended above them, reaching down, though he couldn't tell whether it was reaching for her or for him. The fingers were long, too long. They curved slightly, claw-like, though he couldn't see detail clearly. He didn't look for a face. To this day, he doesn't know if it had one. The apartment was pitch black, every light off, every corner swallowed by darkness. He doesn't know whether the thing emitted light or whether his eyes were simply locking onto movement and shape. He didn't think. He reacted. He grabbed her hard, yanked her out of the bed as she froze in place, her body locked with fear. He didn't shout, didn't swing, didn't hesitate. He dragged her out of the apartment and ran. They didn't stop until they reached a neighbor's place, a friend he trusted, someone who didn't laugh or question or dismiss them. The neighbor let them in, let them sit, let the adrenaline burn itself out. Hours passed. When they finally returned to the apartment, it was empty, silent, normal. Nothing else happened that night. That should have been the end of it. It wasn't. In the weeks that followed, the event refused to stay isolated. It bled into sleep, into memory, into moments when nothing was happening but something still felt wrong. One night she shook him awake, drenched in sweat, breathing hard. She couldn't explain what had happened at first, and only that she had been awake but unable to move, frozen in fear for no clear reason. They researched it later and found the term sleep paralysis, but at the time, the explanation felt thin. A week later, it happened to him. No visions, no sounds, just the crushing certainty that something was present, something close, something watching. He couldn't move, couldn't speak. When it ended, he didn't try to rationalize it. He found them a new place to live. Even after they moved, it didn't fully stop. A couple of months later, he experienced it again, this time while sleeping on his mother's couch. He had stayed over to help with repairs, something ordinary and familiar. He woke unable to move, unable to speak. His leg began to lift into the air on its own. He saw nothing, felt nothing touch him. He prayed. Whether he closed his eyes or woke up from a dream remains unclear. The moment fractured in memory, like a scene that never fully resolves. And that was when he realized something unsettling. The figure on the bed had not been the beginning. It had been the interruption. Because long before that night, long before Afghanistan, long before exhaustion and substances and sleepless weekends, there had been other moments. Moments he had never connected. Moments he could no longer ignore. Once he stopped trying to treat the incident as an isolated event, the timeline began to rearrange itself. The problem wasn't that something new had appeared in his life, it was that something old had resurfaced, and the circumstances of exhaustion and altered sleep had stripped away whatever barriers usually kept it in the background. When he looked back with that in mind, there were moments he had never fully explained. Moments he had boxed off as childhood imagination or stress or coincidence, simply because they were easier to live with that way. The first memory was one he hadn't thought about in years. He was 8 years old when the car accident happened. He had been riding with his father, someone who was more a presence than a constant in his life. The crash itself was a blur, metal, noise, the sudden wrongness of movement, and then nothing. He was rushed to the hospital, slipping in and out of consciousness, his condition critical enough that adults stopped trying to reassure him. The last thing he remembered before everything went dark was the emergency room lights sliding overhead. Then there was blackness, complete and absolute, without sound or sensation. It didn't feel like sleep. It felt like absence. Out of that absence came a pinprick of light. At first it was distant, almost insignificant, but it grew steadily larger until it became a doorway of sorts, bright enough to stand out against the darkness without blinding him. From that light stepped a woman dressed entirely in white. He knew her immediately. It was his grandmother, the one who had died years earlier, long before the accident. She looked the same as she had in memory, calm and familiar, her expression neither urgent nor emotional. She didn't speak. She simply extended her hand toward him, palm open, waiting. The simplicity of the gesture terrified him, and he cried out, not in fear of her, but in refusal. He shouted that he wanted his mother, that he didn't want to go, that he wasn't ready. The words felt desperate and final, as if this was the only choice he would ever be allowed to make. The woman withdrew her hand. She stepped backward into the light, which began to shrink until it disappeared entirely. In the same instant, his eyes flew open and he was staring into the harsh glare of surgical lights, surrounded by voices and movement and urgency. At the time, he never connected that experience to anything paranormal. It felt emotional, symbolic, something his mind had created under extreme stress. People talked about near-death experiences all the time, and this fit neatly into that category. It stayed there for years. The second experience came much later during his deployment overseas. Kandahar was not a place that allowed for introspection. Days blurred into missions, and missions blurred into survival. Sleep, when it came, was shallow and restless, always ready to break at the slightest sound or movement. One night, after returning from a prolonged operation involving sustained fighting, he collapsed onto a couch and fell asleep almost instantly. He woke drenched in sweat, breathing hard, his heart racing as if he had been running. It took time for the dream to return to him. When it did, it came in fragments that slowly assembled into something deeply unsettling. The dream had begun with him looking down at himself from the ceiling. His body lay motionless on a couch in an unfamiliar room. His mother and his living grandmother stood nearby asking if he was all right. Below them, his own body was shouting at them, cursing violently, his voice filled with rage and distortion. They left the room. A Catholic priest entered instead. He remembered this detail clearly, partly because it made no sense. He wasn't Catholic. He had no reason to associate authority or ritual with that imagery. The priest opened a Bible and began to read aloud in what sounded like Latin, his voice steady and controlled. As the words continued, the shouting from his body changed. The voice deepened, stretched, twisted into something monstrous. It became a single, sustained roar that no human throat should have been capable of producing. The room began to vibrate. Then the vibration spread to his vision, his hearing, his entire body, until it felt as if everything, inside and outside, was shaking apart. That violent vibration was what woke him. He sat up gasping for air, the sensation lingering long after consciousness returned. It wasn't fear that stayed with him. It was confusion. The dream hadn't felt symbolic. It had felt procedural, like something being done rather than imagined. At the time, he dismissed it as distress. Combat dreams came in many forms. and this one, however strange, could still be filed away under that explanation. But after the night with the green figure, those old files reopened themselves. He began to notice something else, too. Something that didn't fit neatly into sleep or memory. A presence that no matter where he was, there was a persistent sense of being watched from behind. Not watched in a threatening way, not actively stalked, but observed. When he tried to picture it, the image that came to mind was not the green figure from the apartment. It was darker, more like a shifting black mist lingering just outside his peripheral awareness. It never resolved into a shape, never announced itself. It was simply there, constant and patient. That realization reframed the night in the apartment in a way he hadn't expected. What if the green figure wasn't the source of the fear? What if it was reacting to something already present? By the time he reached that question, the mystery had changed shape entirely. It was no longer about identifying a single entity. It was about understanding a pattern, one that stretched from childhood, through trauma, through war, and into moments of vulnerability, when the boundaries between waking and dreaming thinned. And if that was true, then the night something sat on the bed wasn't an intrusion at all. It was an interruption. Once he allowed himself to consider that possibility, that nothing had followed him home because nothing had ever left, the story stopped behaving like a series of disconnected incidents and started to resemble a single, long-running problem he had never been equipped to name. The green figure was no longer the centerpiece. It was a symptom. He replayed that night in the apartment over and over, not with panic this time, but with distance. The exhaustion, the prolonged lack of sleep, the sudden collapse into darkness, all of it created the perfect conditions for something to surface. Whether psychological, neurological, spiritual, or something that didn't sit cleanly in any one category. But one detail refused to cooperate with a purely internal explanation. His fiancée had seen it too. She hadn't described it in the same way he would have if prompted. She hadn't borrowed language from him or mirrored his fear. She had reacted instantly, viscerally, to something occupying physical space in the room, something that wasn't there a moment before. That shared perception mattered. Sleep paralysis could explain the later episodes, the immobility, the fear, the sense of presence, but it struggled to account for a synchronized visual experience that occurred before either of them fell fully asleep. Especially one that ended not with confusion, but with coordinated flight. That was the point where the mystery split into two competing explanations, neither of which felt complete on its own. One path led toward trauma. 5 years of hypervigilance don't simply switch off when the uniform comes off. The body learns patterns the mind can't override. Exhaustion, substance use, and emotional release can blur the line between waking perception and threat response. The brain fills in gaps. It creates forms for fear when it doesn't know where else to put it. Seen through that lens, the green figure could have been the brain externalizing danger, giving shape to a lifetime of readiness that had nowhere to go anymore. But the other path led somewhere far less comfortable, because the earliest experiences predated trauma. The hospital vision had occurred long before combat, long before adult stress or belief systems had taken root. The wartime dream had felt less like fear and more like intervention, as if something had been identified and addressed without his consent. And the persistent sense of being watched had followed him not to places but to states of vulnerability. Sleep, exhaustion, moments of transition. If there was a presence, it didn't behave like a predator. Predators announce themselves through escalation. This did not. It waited. The more he examined the pattern, the clearer it became that whatever he was experiencing did not seek constant attention. It surfaced when control slipped, when sleep overtook him too quickly, when consciousness thinned, when defenses fell away. And that brought him back to the green figure itself, its posture, its timing. It hadn't attacked. It hadn't spoken. It hadn't chased them when they ran. It had reached, yes, but reaching did not automatically mean harm. Reaching could mean interruption, intervention, removal. That possibility unsettled him more than the idea of an attack ever could. What if the green figure wasn't the threat? What if It was responding to something else in the room. The thought lingered uncomfortably, especially when paired with the dream from Kandahar. In that dream, the violence hadn't come from outside. It had come from his own body. The priest hadn't fought something entering him. He had addressed something already there. Faith complicated the question further. He wasn't someone who framed his life through strict religious doctrine, but he couldn't ignore the consistency of one element. When he asked for help, truly asked, it came. In the hospital, his refusal ended the vision. During paralysis, prayer broke the grip. In moments of fear, invoking something greater than himself shifted the experience. So that didn't provide answers, but it narrowed the field. Over time, the presence faded into the background. It didn't disappear exactly, but it stopped pressing itself forward. The sense of being watched softened, becoming something like awareness rather than surveillance. He slept more easily. The paralysis became rare. Life moved forward. He stopped chasing explanations, not because the mystery was solved, but because it no longer demanded resolution. Some experiences, he came to believe, are not meant to be identified the way we identify objects. They exist at the edges, where biology, belief, memory, and fear overlap, and they resist being pinned down because they don't belong to any single system of understanding. Was the green figure a hallucination born of exhaustion? Possibly. Was it something reacting to a presence only he carried? Also possible. Was it neither of those things? That question remains open. What he knows now is this. Whatever happened that night did not escalate. It did not follow him into every room. It did not destroy his life or take control of it. Whatever was watching, whether internal or external, did not need to act again. And that may be the most important clue of all. Some mysteries don't end because they're solved. They end because whatever needed to happen already did.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.